Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. This is the podcast after Weird Things, so that's why we called it that, where we talk to you about being a creative professional. By you, I mean you, and by we, I mean me, Andrew Main, and Justin Robert Young.
Hello, everybody.
Brian Brushwood.
Yep.
And our special guest today joining us, actually in his home office studio, is Mr. Peter J. Wax, who's actually taller than he looks right now for our video viewers. He's just behind me. So Peter J. Wax is an author of numerous books, including the forthcoming Bloodletting, co-written with Mark Ryan. He also has Second Paradigm, which is available now. He's written a Veronica Mars story, as you can see there, that's available from the Amazon Worlds, was that? Like Heroes. And he's also got the Dandy Boys Mysteries with J.R. Boyette, which is also in the bundle, the Humble Bundle. He's one of my co-authors in the Humble Bundle. Available now for just three more days. Three more days from when we record this. Now's your chance, folks. Get this Humble Bundle, which helps benefit the Science Fiction Writers Association, which will help their Givers Fund, which is for charitable causes. The Challenger Science Space Science Centers, which promotes space and science. Who does not like space or science? We don't want you listening to our podcast.
No, space and science, the hammers and mallets of our modern age.
I mean, there is a difference between the two, but yes, I agree.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, and you should know the difference.
So right really now, there's only a couple more days left on that Humble Bundle. So if you want to hop on over there and buy that, I think for $15, you can get all the books, including four previously unpublished Frank Herbert novels that Peter explained to me were considered a little bit too weird and out there in their day. But right now, on point.
They are. They're absolutely amazing. My favorite of them is Angel's Fall, which is this like survivor story from this plane crash in the Amazon and, you know, people trying to get through the Amazon and weather the terrain. And there's, you know, of course, aliens and stuff. It's Frank Herbert. But it's awesome stuff. But you can see why, you know, surviving a plane crash in a remote place would be zeitgeist now.
Sure.
But lost on the 50s and 60s.
I don't know if that still's like, guys, but yes.
Right.
Hey, guys, part of what we like to do here is we like to try to give some advice to people. We're not licensed advice givers, and everything we say should be maybe broached with a doctor first. But I think we have actually an email from somebody who wants our wise counsel.
Oh, yeah. Take it away, Bryce.
Okay, this is from James Harrison.
Oh, I know this James. Yeah. This is a friend of the show for a very long time. Yeah.
He writes, "Hey, weird hosts, I don't know if you've covered this question, but I'll ask anyway. I've come up with a magic trick that I've performed for several hundred people, including numerous restaurants, performed many times on stage and at the Magic Convention in Toronto, and it was very well received. I've thought about putting it out on the market, but a couple of things make me hesitant. First, the trick is not 100% original, though to be fair, nothing ever is, especially in magic. How do I know if I change the trick enough that it's worth publishing and worth putting out on the market for purchase? Second, how do I go about actually getting the product in front of customers? Do I attempt to try to sell it on my own, or do I go out to one of the bigger companies there? Thanks in advance, James Harrison."
Hey, so this is interesting because I wonder how much of the, I think both me and Andrew could, and certainly Justin could speak to a bit of what we understand the gentleman's rules in the world of magic. Magic is a lot like comedy in the fact that we don't have any kind of, in comedy you could copyright the words of a joke, but you can't really prevent someone from ripping off the beats of a joke, the heart of it. There are similar situations. So as a result, in magic, you kind of have to self-enforce this kind of stuff. In the world of authoring, before we talk about it in the world of magic, I would love to know if you have any insights on, do authors get accused of, I'm saying this knowing full well the answer, but do authors get accused of completely ripping off note for note the works of other folks?
Peter explained to me an example of this, and I don't know how much you can describe or say to that effect, but of a very popular TV and, you know, series based on a fantasy series, and
Okay, you're going to have to remind me because my my mouth wags and my brain shuts off.
So I don't want to say anything, but we can speak a roundabout, and then I will. I'm gonna draw you a little picture here. But that is absolutely
is coming out
like 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Grey is the great example. Mm-hmm. It was originally a fanfic written about the Twilight universe, and it was doing so well as fan fiction that she basically just rebranded it, and she changed vampires and werewolves into business people. Of course, a lot of people have said, oh, well, she just ripped it off from Twilight. She just whatever. But, I mean, to the tune of a $1 billion franchise, does it matter?
And nobody watching reading 50 Shades of Grey would, at that point, it went through several evolutions to where it became 50 Shades. Nobody reading it now or seeing the movie is going to think, this is Twilight.
Right.
You have to know the history of it in order to know the connection. But there have been other examples in fantasy genres and urban fantasy where somebody has a really interesting premise and maybe an author puts out a book once every 2 years or so and somebody else goes, I like this premise. I'm going to do that too. And then that thing, maybe because they release more frequently, becomes more popular and maybe gets optioned for TV and causes problems. But
And there is a big case that you can find if you go and hunt around paranormal. If you go and hunt around for paranormal romance and urban fantasy and look for, maybe some big stories about people who are taking things. Another one recently was actually Sandra Bullock.
Gravity, yeah.
Gravity, yeah. That was actually a really big deal. Mm-hmm. Somebody who had... a writer who had not only put out the book, but who had written and sold the screenplay for it. And then it coming around through several mergers and acquisitions to basically being very same scripts, lawsuits back and forth.
Yeah, it was the woman who, I forget her name, she's the one that created Rizzoli and Isles, but she wrote a book about a woman on a space station trying to stop a plague that's affected her husband.
Yeah.
And it was called Gravity. And so the large theme is female doctor, space station, crisis. And then when Gravity first came out, she made a statement saying, this is different from mine, blah, blah, blah. But then she says something different. And we don't know. And it may have been new information came out about, could be that, where development went and whatever. Because sometimes people option something and the option's up and they go in a different direction. But maybe they have elements. So I won't say either way. I know nothing about that particular case, know really what's going on. But it's certainly it's going to be problematic because those things are really – you have to – it's almost impossible to win one of those things if they're not really taking verbatim things from you.
Strengths here mentions, did they remove the necrophilia and bestiality from 50 Shades? I want to point out that you're actually missing a key component. There's also pedophilia in there when the 200-year-old is chasing the 15-year-old girl.
Oh, jeez.
Listen, man, we all got local laws and customs. all politics is local.
So, in answer to the question about the magic trick, if you say you have something that's not 100% implying, but it's different, but then you say, hey, but if I change it enough, can I then market it? Which means it's not different enough right now. And so your goal is, can I change this even more and then market it? First things first is it's you have to ask, what is your goal? If your goal is reputation and you want to release it, then your responsibility is to reach out to the creator, if there's still a person creating, making money from the original version, and say, hey, do I have your permission to do this? If they say no, then if your goal is reputation, then you back off and you say, okay, I'm not going to do that. If your goal is purely financial, then you can say, okay, legally I'm within these terms, I can do this, do that. And if you find that it's an attractive enough product that other people want to carry, and that's the hard part a lot of people have to understand, is they go, well, I'm in the right to do this. Legally you can imitate a lot of things, but are you going to be accepted by the magic community? They're not going to go, well, yeah, technically you're right, that's okay with us. If they perceive you as ripping somebody off or profiting unfairly from it, there's a penalty for that.
Now, if it's only pieces of the construct, not mm-hmm. the entire effect, just small pieces, would something like, doing a hats off or a nod to the inspiration, say pieces of this trick were inspired by this?
Speaking in generalities, it's hard.
Yeah, magic is not a matter of. There are only so many ways that you can make a certain thing happen in general. And I would say there is nothing that can go wrong, in my opinion, unless you are just looking to put out as much as possible and have, you know, the chips fall where they may because you don't care about your reputation within the industry, to reach out, you know, and have more information rather than less. And when you reach out to people, try to come out as open-palmed as possible, because very often magic creators are very, very defensive of things that they've done. And you will find very, very quickly resources and creators and people, historians, that will be able to point you in the right direction on who to talk to and in what areas you are either going to have to massage the trick to make it significantly different, or if you are in the right. But the more information you have, specifically within magic, and again, there are 20 people in the entire magic industry, so you know these people are not hard to find. Everybody's got everybody's email.
Well,
yeah, there.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, please, Brian.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it's really not rocket science if you're going to release something in magic. Just imagine what you expect the most obvious negative response you'll get. If somebody wanted to cause trouble, they're going to call you a ripoff of somebody's thing, right? So reach out to that guy and say you reached out to that guy. And then the ball's in that guy's court. Either he's going to say, I am the arbiter of this is too close to my stuff and I'm going to be the one who tells you no. Then you know, you then take that back, and the guy, then you could say publicly, hey, I do a variation on this routine. You know, if you bought it from this guy, I wanted to release it. He said I can't, but, you know, here's my variation. I'm going to give away for free if, you know, if assuming you've bought this guy's original routine, so the original creator gets whatever. Then you maintain the reputational high ground in that regard. Or, but that's not likely what's going to happen. What's likely going to happen is you're going to say, hey, this is based on your idea, your routine. I want to lavish praise upon you and tell the whole world that they should really buy your work because it's very good. And that person will be very flattered, very honored. It will raise his prestige within the magic community, and he'll probably be fine with it.
Yeah, if they're, you know, if you're taking money out of somebody's pocket, then you're going to get one reaction. You know, and there's, I have a trick called Teardown, which is an impromptu newspaper tear. And when I perform it in magic lectures, it's one of the strongest pieces. The core of that effect came from a trick invented by Jim Steinmeier called the incessant newspaper tear, which appeared in his book, The Conjuring Anthology, which is a fantastic book. And I was digging through there and I saw this, said, man, there's this method, but I could use this in an impromptu setting. I could use it for this way. I reached out to Jim and I said, hey, you know, I love this method. I have this different version of this. You know, can I, you know, pay you an honorarium or whatever for this to use it and all that and mention the book in the video? Super gracious, super eager to do that, you know. But he deals with people who will say, like, hey, can I use this? And will you send me a copy of your book to plug? You know? And so there's the opposite effect. And he was cool, and but he didn't have to say yes to that, you know. And it could have been, I would have tried to find out some different, we would not have drawn a comparison between the two tricks other than if you knew the method, but I wanted to do the right thing, and he's an amazing magic creator, and I wanted to respect that.
Here's what I suspect happens to a lot of magicians, is they have an idea, and they're scared to ask the person who inspired it, because they're afraid that they'll say no. And then what they end up doing is making things much, much worse for themselves, because then they do it first, and then they find themselves in a position where they have to, you know, they're either crossing their fingers, and they're like, oh, nobody realized that it's awfully similar to this other guy's thing, or, you know, blows up, in which case they deeply regret it, and then they have to offer a billion mea culpas. Don't make it a either he gives you permission or you're screwed situation. Instead, he's either going to say, yes, that's lovely, please mention me in your notes, and you'll do that. Or he'll say, no, I'm not cool with this. In which case, in your mind right now, just decide you're still going to publish it, but you're going to publish it as supplementary notes that is your an essay on your variations that doesn't give away his method, that makes it clear that if you want to do this trick, you need to buy it from this guy, but this is the James Harrison variation on that, if you have that
try. I mean, I would even say, like, if he says yes, if he says no, then drop it. Don't even, because if he says no, and then you go put out some material relating to it, even if you're not exposing it or whatever, that could be construed from that person's point of view that he asked you not to do it, or that it was a criticism of his presentation. It just, it won't. I can see many ways that that would, your best intentions would go the other way.
And you know, but I mean, I think the biggest thing is just communication. Communicate with him. Say if he's like, no, I don't like it as a commercial thing. And then if you say, all right, well, I was thinking about it. I really like it. And I've never released anything and I'd like to gain a bit of a reputation in doing this. Do you mind if I publish it for free and link to your thing? And if he says no to that, then yeah, then drop it. But like there's no reason why it has to, like, I think so often, specifically in Magic, it gets to this like, well, I'm out of moves. I have no other moves but to do this thing. And so often that comes from lack of communication, from people digging in their heels. And this is not only from people doing things that are out of pocket, that don't have the rights or the blessings of the original creators and are legitimately looked upon as stealing from the table of somebody who put a lot of hard work into it, but also on the other side, the Magic Police, for which many of us have dear friends that relish in the opportunity to point fingers and shame somebody who's walked on the wrong side of that line. And I understand the need to do it, but it creates a environment where people are gun shy, and you don't necessarily need to be. Just be in communication, talk to people, figure out what, you know, the more that you can figure out where the lines are based on what you've done and what that person's done and the way that you can make a thing happen, then the better off you're going to be, and not just kind of constantly looking at the doomsday scenario of like, well, what if? Because that is the opposite of progress.
Well, the doomsday scenario, I have an example of this in fiction. I'm going to leave names out of it very specifically. But there was a writer who wrote a story that was inspired by a song from the 70s. Incredible song. I would guess that everyone has heard it. The writer contacted the estate of that musician and requested permission to say, you know, this story was inspired by this song. And what came back from the estate was no. And not only no, but we hate science fiction so much that if you publish this, we are going to have lawyers scrub through this story looking for any reference to this song so that we can sue you. That's the doomsday. That's the only story that I have ever heard about the actual doomsday happening.
Yeah.
And with the number of stories you hear about collaboration, about inspiration, to have only heard one story from my side, I don't think it's that big of a risk.
And that's why we'll never read Tales from the Starship Shyamalama Ding Dong.
I think in Magic, you're dealing with a very small community, and you're dealing with personalities that can be, you know, frustrated if they feel. And then it promises you're not dealing with reality. You're dealing with the perception of reality. You're dealing with what people perceive to be true. And Brian and I have gone back and forth this. I'll be like, oh, hey, everybody is upset about this, but they don't have any information about it. But people are still acting like telltale little children, like, oh, you know who did this? You know who did this or whatever? And you find out that there's no facts there. It's just that people, you know, want to be angry. They want to pick on somebody for whatever reason. And so to James, back to his cases, James, my question, the thing to me is like, if you're saying you have to change it to release it, then that means what you're doing isn't sufficiently changed. And if you do want to change it and want to release it, like Justin said, just talk. If it's a living person with an existing thing, talk to them, have a conversation.
And if it's not a living person, reach out to their estate.
Yeah. Or whoever owns the publishing on it. I think what he might also be saying is, how do I find that person? Because I think that's for somebody that is, you know, just invent something, but he doesn't know exactly where to find it. So if you guys have both been in situations where you want to release something that has a prior history to it, how do you find out who these people are? Who do you go to talk to?
You know, the one of the resources we used to always go to was Martin Gardner, who's since passed away. Another person who's knowledgeable is Max Maven, Max's job is not to be at our beck and call to answer our questions about who created what, but he's often very generous with that. You can reach out to, you know, Magic Castle Library. You know, you can actually write a letter to them and say, hey, I'm trying to find the history of that. We got Bill Goodwin, Lisa Cousins. We got great librarians there that, you know, can actually help people answer these questions. So there are people. Reach into the Magic community. Show up at a Magic club or go to a Magic convention and say, hey, how do I find this out? And you're going to find very quickly message boards. If you go into Magic Cafe or whatever, you're two steps away from finding that answer very quickly.
Yeah,
that's a lot faster than in Lit.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. It's
Lit,
a small.
You have to dig through with lawyers. You have to find, you know, the chain of custody on the copyrights. There's all sorts of stuff you have to do.
Well, and also what'll happen though too in Magic is you'll find out who people believe to be the creator. And one of the problems too is if you're there are many times where somebody's been beat down because like, oh, they ripped off so and so, and you know, well, actually, the person who we all love and respect didn't invent that, you know, and so it's kind of like, you know, it's about perceptions. It's not about really you want to do what's right, but also what's perceived as right.
Also, a cool resource is Ask Alexander. That's not going to probably do you a ton of. It's not going to help you a ton in terms of finding.
I use Magicpedia all the time. Genie's Magicpedia has a bunch of precedents that tells you which trick begat which trick by whom and so on.
Yeah, and you know that will do more for you learning about the history of the trick and where things have come. Add on throughout history, but again. Magic's 20 people wide. You literally can just throw a rock at somebody and they will say, ow, why'd you throw a rock at me? And you can say, because I want to find out who initiated Card to Pocket.
Yeah, there was a group of some magician creators who got together to put together a site to protect their rights on some stuff. And it did not go well when I had a conversation with them because like, oh, you know, we want to enforce rights on this trick and this trick. And I'm like, well, part of your consortium says this is their trick and this is their trick. These tricks, that one's 40 years older. That's 80 years older than them. And so you're going to bring down your weight on anybody who does those tricks, even though it's not original to them. And like, well, you know, he's known for this. I'm like, that's not the same. That is not the same because guess what? In that case, David Copperfield and David Blaine own all of Magic.
Right. Correct. And that's the problem, right, is that people, when they overreact, and the only reaction you get in Magic is overreaction, they're overreacting because, well, it's what? Obvious that this is the – that so-and-so owns it because that's who I saw it do first. And then who's this other guy think he is?
Yep. Whoever you see it first, that's who you attribute it to.
Yep.
We also had the second half of this email, if you guys want to touch on that quickly.
Oh, yeah, please.
Second, how do I go about actually getting the product in front of customers? Do I attempt to try and sell it on my own? Do I go to one of the bigger companies out there?
All right. So you come up with a trick, and it's original, sufficiently original. You talk to the person that you want to talk to. Everything's kosher. You want to put it out. Here are your options. You can either do it as a PDF. You can do it as a video. And from there, you know, no matter what, you're writing it digitally or you're shooting a video, you can send it to among the major players, Illusionist, Penguin, Theory 11. These are all places for which are constantly on the lookout for young creators with fresh methods. Many of them will front you money. They are good for you to raise your profile as a Magic creator in the industry, or you can do it totally indie. Put it in a PDF. If you have any kind of a standing in message boards or places where magicians gather, you know people that are around you within your scene that might like to purchase it. You can sell it to them, and then past that, there's also wholesale opportunities like Murphy's Magic. And
here's an interesting question: is you have to decide whether or not you releasing this, are you planting seeds or are you harvesting? If you're planting seeds, then you're saying, "Oh, I'm going to raise my presence in the industry. I'll be known more as a creator. I've offered this contribution to the art." And in which case, you probably don't care too much about how much money is being made. You want it to get the word out about you and your magic and build your reputation. If you're harvesting, then you already have a brand. You have a pipeline. You have a mailing list. You have your fans that you can reach out to, and you want to maximize your profits and get the most out of it. One thing that I don't know if Justin mentioned is Theory 11 has The Wire, where you can publish. You know, you don't even need them to. Oh, I guess they curate it to an extent, but basically, it's like the iTunes of independent magic creations.
Okay, so I have a quick question for you guys. It's become a really, you know, standard tactic inside of speculative fiction to use Kickstarter to push promotion, to push branding, to complete projects. And it's some people say it's for the money. Most people, they've already written the project. They've already done whatever they're going to do. They're actually attempting to use the Kickstarter to garner new fan base, to bring in new people, to build the mailing list. It's more of a promotional tool. How effective would that be in a situation like this?
Not very.
No,
I would Quint's answer. Yeah,
the reason I would say is this: is Kickstarter works really well when you either have a built-in audience that's already ready there to support you, or an amazing product that people are going to, that sells itself. They go, "This is incredible." If you're trying to market a magic trick, you're going to have to put up a video that shows the trick, and then you're going to have everybody in the world deconstructing what they've seen and deciding they're going to do that. I don't think there is a market for doing magic in that way on there. The amount of time and energy that he'll have to spend to make a good video, he would be better off doing. And also, Kickstarter, you raise money to theoretically to get your cost up, cover for distribution. But if it's a trick that he can make a video of, then I'd say, yeah, put on Theory 11's The Wire, which I think is a great resource. If you don't have the resources to produce a quality version of it and it needs a video, reach out to Penguin, reach out to Theory 11, reach out to Illusionist and say, hey, I have a trick. But if you can produce it on your own, like you can do, you know, you go on the cafe, say I have 100 copies of this, you know, I don't know if there's a market for this, whatever. See the reaction. If there's demand, you'll know there's demand. But Kickstarter can be good for some things. Like Brian used Indiegogo to create his scam stuff brand.
Well, or yeah, at least to get it started. Essentially, we used it as essentially we used it as a pre-sale operation. We had kind of a very singular product that was going to be, I think, $39. And we put together the it's still there. Look at that. That's wonderful. As an artifact. As a matter of fact, Scam Stuff, the online store, is exactly as old as my daughter is, because you'll notice in this video I point out the fact that we're having a third daughter and I needed to figure out a way to spend more time at home and still make money. So we wanted to start an online store. We set an attainable goal and did it as a pre-sales event, and we were very, very pleased with the results.
The only thing I could think of that magic-wise would have any kind of cachet with Kickstarter, and even then I can't think of a way that you'd be able to do a video that would not be like just destroyed by the magic industry itself, which is, as you might imagine, very, very serious and volatile when it comes to the ideas of things being revealed or tipped or too revealing to a general lay audience, but would be some kind of physical prop. And even then, yeah, I mean, like, by and large, there's not a whole lot in magic that costs so much that it's a mass market item. You know, there's plenty of props that cost a whole lot, that cost thousands of dollars, but they're specialty items, and you're selling it to a very, very specialty crowd. Kickstarter, for whatever reason, just doesn't. See, I can't think of something that would make a ton of sense in the Kickstarter world.
Yeah, it's been great for like novelty decks of cards and stuff. But I think that ultimately there are a lot of really good existing marketplaces. It's not hard if you're a young creator with a good idea to get it to market in Magic at all. You know, the choice is, do you want to do it on your own or do you want to work with an existing player? And the advantage of the existing players is they're pretty much straight shooters and they have built-in market to promote it, push it.
But listen, there are people in this world, and I will name them for you: Jonathan Baim, Alvo Stockman, Tim Cherno, whose job it is, they got to carve out X amount of their day to watch web videos of trembling teenage fingers with webcam shooting into their laps doing some kind of trick to demonstrate that is the trick that they have, that they would like to sell. This is something that they have to do and watch probably dozens of every day to make sure that there is new, fresh stuff that they are putting out on their stores. So don't hesitate to send it to them, see if they're interested in it. And otherwise, yeah, put it on The Wire, put it out there, see what you can do.
Gentlemen, want to go to picks?
Sure.
Yeah, I got a quick pick. It's not really anything on the behind-the-scenes stuff that we usually talk about on After Things, but I did see Jungle Book, and I thought it was a fascinating bookend too. I saw Zootopia a few weeks ago, and Zootopia is a cartoon that does an exquisite job of approaching real mannerisms of animals, whereas Jungle Book is, visually appear to be real life animals approaching the personalities of human cartoons. Man, oh man, did the Jungle Book make me realize how good Zootopia is. Jungle Book had brief moments of brilliance, and it started off strong and it ended strong, but there was a lot of... I don't tend to ever check my watch during movies, but I must have checked 3 or 4 times in this. I was a bit surprised by that. But it had a lot of heart, and it did a good job of giving nods and winks to the original animation, and I don't know. That's all I got to say. Yeah, check it out and tell me where I'm wrong.
Did we get the songs?
Yeah, you do. But as Bonnie pointed out... Nowadays, when you watch a Disney musical, it's very, very highly polished, and it makes a lot of sense. But this is given in the context. You got Bill Murray almost on key, almost singing at the same time as Mowgli, singing Bare Necessities, and it's more like the three of us singing Bare Necessities while a Zydeco band was playing in the background. And it was kind of adorable in that it didn't even try to do it. And they change up some of the angles and stuff. Christopher Walken is fantastic as Louie. It was great. It was good in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I haven't seen Jungle Book yet, but Zootopia is one of those, very Pixar and Marvel kind of inspired scripts where you can tell that movie was, and in some of the behind the scenes, that movie was very, very, very dark. And they realized that it was too dark. And it was kind of dragging down the enjoyment of the movie. And you can see there are things that are just grafted on top of that movie that are just like gags. Like just straight out absolute silly, doesn't necessarily plug into the plot. There's a whole thing about an app that, literally is just there to be a silly scene where characters can look and be silly to kind of make sure that brew ultimately comes out at the right pH level. I'm excited to see Jungle Book, but I would very much also a double recommendation to Zootopia.
Yeah, it was funny because I left, I just wanted to, if schedules were different, if we didn't have kids, I would have just made my wife, who did not get to see Zootopia with her, or with us, I would have just pushed her straight into Zootopia immediately afterward if I could have.
I mean, it is weird that we even put those two together, though.
Well, right? I mean, they're thematically the same. They're anthropomorphized animals telling a story with the counterintuitive thing of them all getting along together. You got scenes of, birds and panthers and tigers and elephants all hanging out together. Like that ever happens? It's very weird to me that the two of those came out so close and they're so very different.
But apparently they're both going to make $1 jillion. So for whatever Disney's doing, man, they got to read on it because Jungle Book opened gigantic. Hey, I got a pick. I want everybody to follow at Contender Game on Twitter and Facebook.com/TheContenderGame. Go ahead and like that because we spent all yesterday shooting what I think are very, very, very funny videos. We decided to take cards, contender cards, real cards, and stage the greatest debates that have never happened in American history. So we have a Bill versus Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders versus Richard Nixon. I thought it was pretty funny, and we're going to be We're going to be putting those out over the next couple weeks as we get them edited up. But yeah, actually, if you scroll up a little, Bryce, these are some of the behind the scenes pictures from the shoot yesterday. That's our Bernie Sanders, and I was very, very proud. If you keep going, our intro, I was very, very proud of. We shot that, so it's like all you'll see is just that thing with all these pictures kind of moving by, but it's all papercraft and sock puppets. I was super proud of all the hard work that Guts and Glory put into it. And I think we got a ton of stuff that we're going to be seeding out over the next couple weeks. Not only the clips themselves of the debates, but we did a ton of ad lib with all the presidents. So we'll have a lot of really, really fun stuff. go ahead and follow those accounts because I think that y'all are really going to dig it.
Peter, do you have a pick?
Can I pick the Humble Bundle? Because that's shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, sure. Pick it.
Actually, with the politically charged atmosphere that I've been seeing more and more on social media these days and all of the seriousness that's floating around, I would love to throw a pick out there of Cards Against Humanity. Go relax with some friends and just have some good old fun.
Well, I'll have to explain to Peter what the contender is.
So maybe I think it's a follow through on the contender.
I'm going to recommend my book, The Third Paradigm.
Really? Okay.
No. Cards Against Humanity is a great. If you're tired of politics and playing the wonderful card game, is the contender? Then yes.
No. Listen. Cards Against Humanity is the only card game on Amazon that has a higher customer satisfaction rating than the contender. So if you're not playing the contender, then I suggest by stars alone, you should be playing Cards Against Humanity.
Hey, Peter's got the Cards Against Humanity public, the consumer information line number if you need that.
And it is one of the funniest things that can happen is just sitting there going through their phone tree. It's 312-756-0834. As I understand it, it was set up as a joke at a convention. One of their reps kind of let slip that the number existed, and it's only gone viral.
You can't find
that number.
Yeah.
You just have to be given that number by somebody who has gotten it from someone.
That's funny. Awesome. So everybody
My pick before we wrap things up here and we'll lose our connection again is The Everything Store by Brad Stone. I probably mentioned it before. It is about the birth and growth of Amazon, which has become this giant of industry. We think of Amazon, we think of books, but it's getting everything else to your door and has now become a major back end for the web. You know, if you want to do a startup, you might be building on top of Amazon's web services. And Jeff Bezos is using his Amazon money to launch Blue Origin, which is not Amazon. It's a separate venture for him, but it is an amazing story of a modern enterprise and sort of the shape of things to come in many ways.
Right on.
That is awesome. And glad, look, we got the internet connection back. The miracles never cease.
For now. It's been awesome. After.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.